Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Hey, I'm Graham.
This is Greg.
I am Josh from Tokyo Police Club.
Formerly Suburbia, fourth or sixth label?
So you had Paper Bag, then Saddle Creek, then Dine Alone Mom and Pop, then Memphis Overseas.
Right, Memphis Industries, yes.
Process in Australia.
Mean Beard
Records. Mean Beard.
All right, let's see. 13-year-ish for this band. Is it something that you're like, you're in the van and you're like, how come no one actually ever asks us ...
I feel like this sounds like passive aggressive. It's not a question in particular, but I just feel like the things that people wound up being curious about our band were the exact opposite things that I was either hoping or assuming. I was like, it's very superficial. Everyone just wants to know about, they want you to repeat back to them the things that you put in your official bio or whatever. And I feel like this whole time I've been gearing up to talk. I'm like, yeah, let's talk about all this. Let's do it. I want to talk, man. And someone's like, cool, awesome. Let's go deep. Why did you call your album TPC? So I feel like just the entire angle of questioning has been completely askew.
Wow.
Let's keep digging.
Are you up there? Help me. All right. That TPC, album number 4, Church in Rural Ontario, Lakeside Summer Camp. Now, I originally wrote the words, why there? I know the answer to that question, and we're going to get into the deep, dark, oh, would there have been a band for this album and all that lovely shite? How many spaces did you look at, and how did you kind of negotiate where that space? And by the way, I'll just fill it in so you don't have to say it. Your friends, Born Ruffians, recommended the space. But when you were at that moment of kind of non-collusion and like, ooh, this is not going to work and I don't know, why did this space become the Zen spot?
Well, it's exactly because it was that moment of non-collusion. We didn't audition spaces or like think about it. Because I think everyone kind of had their foot off the gas and their mind on other things. Someone said, how about this space? And we said, sure, just book it. It's cheap. And then we went up there. It was the first place that came to mind. And I don't know if it had been, I really wonder if we'd got there and it had sucked, what would have happened if we would have changed, if we would have changed spaces, if we just would have stuck with it, if that would have been the straw that broke the camel's back and we would have not made the record. But we got there, we're like, great, it's beautiful, done.
Did you get to the demo stage there? Where did you get to before you went to Los Angeles, which we'll get to in a second, he said in a run-on sentence. How far did you get on the songs in Zenland?
The songs existed as like voice memos from Dave at first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, great. So, yeah, we're still using the script.
The voice memo app on the stupid phone has changed the music industry. Maybe one of the most underrated sea changes, because now everyone remembers the songs they write. You used to have to phone your answering machine, I guess. That was before our time. But you used to have to, like, get it over the finish line. Now you're just like, sketch it out.
And we used to use one of those, like, portable, like, Zoom recorders, but they were a pain in the ass to get the audio up. Yeah, just capture the idea. Just capture the idea as it goes. Voice memo works amazing for that. And we had the equivalent of voice memo at the church.
We took, you know, decent microphones, just a couple stereo mics, and recorded in the room and would overdub the vocals. By, like, the third time we went to the church, we're like, you want to just put someone's iPhone on a stool somewhere? Because I think that that we used to demo a lot, like Force Field, we demoed the shit out of. No, not like we used to, and that kept the songs, like, they stayed fluid. So when we got to the studio, instead of being like, let's record the verse, chorus, verse structure, we're like, let's try this. Oh, hey, should we just change that? And then, like, they never felt like we chiseled them into stone until we recorded them.
So therefore, here's the segue, you didn't bring Rob Schnaff demos.
No, never.
You brought him voice memos.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, back to producer of album number 2. So how did you think about that, and what was the reasoning? Because obviously album number 3 led to a lot of non-collusion. I like saying that. So what was it comforting to go back to the guy that you liked in L.A.?
Yeah, I think there was a certain amount of comfort there. It was our first big kind of step out of our comfort zone, ironically. So to go back to what wasn't our comfort zone as being our new comfort zone was kind of refreshing. I think we, in the same way that we chose the church because we knew a bunch of things that didn't work before and we were trying to correct them, we figured why not go back to somebody that had a very positive impact on how we worked and see if the same thing still exists. And
so when you approached him and you go, okay, this is our album that comes out of pain, and you got a challenge ahead of you because there ain't no demos. This is as naked as anything could possibly be, but we visualize, or I should say hear, the songs. Is that what you did? What was the discussion? How did the discussion go?
Well, Rob is maybe a lot of producers we haven't worked with that many would be great for this, but Rob was great because I don't think that he'd be that interested in demos even if we sent him the shiniest demos ever. He wants to hear you play the songs. So we went into the studio and he mic'd everything up and then we'd just play through them and he would listen to them and react. And so like that, which was the perfect exact thing we needed with these songs, was to get them into someone else's brain and out of our collective brain. And yeah, I mean, we didn't talk that much about it. We had another plan that kind of fell through, and then shit, who should produce the record? And then someone said Rob, and we were all like, oh yeah, that's obvious. And then we booked flights to LA and did it.
Yeah, he's really not the kind of producer that's like, this song, I hear acoustic guitar and a feature from a country artist and something else. He's like, I get what you're trying, what emotions you're evoking in this song, and what message you want to send, and this is how I think the best way to do that is, and you're playing it.
And is his studio very tricked out, or is it really kind of a cozy home kind of place?
Very cozy. He has the gear that he needs to make records, and that's it. There's nothing fancy beyond that. It's just, there's a comfy couch, there's a comfy outdoor space, and there's a bucket for a bunch of cold Modelos, and that's basically it.
Who wants to tell the story about the 11-hour drive to Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, we were starting, I don't even remember what tour it was. We were starting some tour in Chicago, and Dave was like flying to meet us or whatever, because he was living in New York. And so the three of us got the van and filled it with the gear and did the drive. I mean, this is standard beginning of tour stuff. And it was sort of right at the end of the touring cycle for the two EPs we put out in 16, which had been not exactly gone according to anyone's expectations or hopes. And I think everyone had, without speaking, because we're like a really functional band, but we're not always the most communicative, because if someone's sort of having internal strife, they keep it to themselves so as not to like kill the mood, which generally I think, you know, we do pretty good at compartmentalizing, but we were driving and, you know, it's a long, boring drive, and it just sort of, not in an acrimonious way at all, but just in sort of the analytical, circular, conversational way that we do. Yeah, it just started to come, it became apparent that we kept trying to have conversations about like the conversations we were about to have about what's the plan for the record, what's the plan for touring, what's the plan for next year, and the conversations kept bamming into walls, and we really quickly realized like, oh, we can't have these conversations because everyone is so blocked up and gets so like tongue-tied and anxious about the concept of like tomorrow in this band, let alone 5 years from now, that oh shit, we need to talk about this. And also for me, at least, it was the first time I was terrified that like, I'm going to ruin it. I'm the one that's causing trouble. I'm the one who's the malcontent. And we, I think, all had felt different degrees of that. And everyone was like, no, I feel that too. And it was sort of this, it's like a low part of the narrative because it was the beginning of us talking, like maybe we'd break up. But in the moment, for me at least, it felt like a huge relief. I was like, oh fuck, at least this is real. At least I'm not completely off my rocker. At least I'm not completely delusional to be thinking this. And then we just hashed it out. And we basically talked ourselves into a place where it was acceptable to entertain the notion that maybe this wasn't the be-all and end of all of our lives. And I think that was, it's very obvious. Of course it isn't. It's a fucking band. We're lucky to be able to do it this long. But it felt like a really radical notion at the time. And I think that was the beginning of whatever process needed to happen.
So the reverse engineering to actually write and play what you love versus what's going to make you big. Why don't we just make a record we're going to enjoy? How do you get from 11 hours in Chicago to, oh, revelation? We don't have to do this the same way.
We definitely started thinking, oh, well, we like us. Of course we're going to be big. Of course we'll like have some success and you know, be bigger than we think we're going to be. But then I think the point that at least I felt differently was post-Champ in the writing for Force Field. We took a long time to do it, and that was maybe the beginning of things starting, us starting to realize that things were out of our hand, that there were maybe too many people with a little bit too much, not that it's their fault at all, that we were giving too much credit and listening to their opinions too much, and it extended. There's a reason why there was no record in 2012, and that's because we were tied up in this huge machine that we had gotten involved with, and it wasn't until after the EPs that we decided to tear it all down and do something that felt better to our souls.
Yeah, I feel like I'm noticing as we continue to sort of talk and do interviews and narrativize and mythologize this process as inevitably happens, that I really want to skewer the idea that, like, you know, it's so tempting to be like, and then we decided that everyone else needs to get out of the way. And this grand moment where the symphony swells, every creative process and everything we've ever done is just, we're fucking throwing the tracks in front of ourselves. And you just, like, you follow them where they lead. And in retrospect, what we did this one was, like, we threw the tracks in a, you know, a left turn where we used to turn right. And it involved turning away from a lot of other shit that we used to think was important. But, like, it wasn't some grand plan to reject influence or to reclaim our independence. We were just, like, doing the only thing that felt, like, doable at the time. And it felt exciting. And, you know, we just followed it like we always do.
All right. I never know what my favorite track's going to be. And I listened to the album multiple times and I had just enough time to really track it on the way here. And so I'm going to, again, enter backwards. Why do you think you effed up on Letterman?
I mean, we did Letterman 3 times, which is my favorite brag to do. And because people understand it. Yeah, our grandparents get it. And on the second time, and, you know, especially back then, it was 2008, we put out Elephant Shell, our first debut LP on Saddle Creek, big American, amazing, fancy record label. And everyone's in New York. The label's there. Our manager's there. Our agent's there. We do Letterman. And we're doing a million promo things. And we've been on tour. And we're 21, so we don't know how to take care of ourselves. And Dave's voice is kind of shot. And you have to do this. You have to show up at Letterman at 6 in the morning. And so it's not great. So he just was like, had very little voice. And we sort of scraped through it with sort of a hoarse, scratchy, Leonard Cohen-esque lead vocal. Which is just a damn shame and a bad coincidence and bad timing. But the fact that it was sort of mythologized into being a fuck, I think, speaks to a lot of the pressure that we, and specifically Dave as the lead singer, felt around everything we did. And, like, the mere act of displaying human frailty was somehow some kind of fuck and not just, like, a natural part of life, especially life on the road.
Sad, dark, funny song, because it's what everybody wants to actually say.
Yes.
And it's what everybody's actually thinking.
Yes.
But they never are willing to go there.
Were you saying that, like, that song is, if you're, that's kind of the point that people either stay on the train or they get off, because it's so honest that if you come at it with any kind of cynicism or negative attitude towards it, you'll think it's the lamest song ever. Yeah. But if it resonates with you, then it's your f-ing jam. And I think that's really interesting to see. Not that I've seen it in any of the audiences that come to the show, but definitely with reviews and people listening to the album, if they point that one out and they kind of snark at it a bit, you're like, oh, you seem unhappy in your life then.
How did you get from where you started to big, 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 bigger, but not too big that it turned into this massive heavy metal jam thing and it remained true to the band?
I think we've learned a lot over the years and we've become very strong, stronger than we've ever been in our convictions, but we are not strong enough to resist the temptations of the recording studio. And not that you should have to. I don't think it's inherently more virtuous to do it, like, with no overdubs, but you always go in, we're going to do like the Beatles did it, all in a room. We're not even going to use headphones. Get me a big speaker as the monitor. It's going to be great. No editing, none of this, none of the other. No comping. One take, one take, one take. And then you get there and it's like, yeah, or you could make it sound awesome with just the one press of the button. And so of course you press the button. We're only human. I think that idea of, like, because everyone's just trying to get towards some kind of perceived authenticity, but just the very act of, like, listening to a record or listening to music is inherently has artifice about it, because decisions were made the whole way along. Like, you're not here, you're not in the room with someone while they invent a song for the first time, unless you're at some kind of avant-garde, you know, performance or whatever. So every step of the way from conception through to the time it makes it to your ears is considered, and it's filtered through the brains of people, and that necessitates artifice, and which is fine. That's part of the process. I just think that the weird cultural idea that that's somehow dishonest or less virtuous is just making it harder to enjoy music, which seems like not the goal.
Almost everybody at this moment in a conversation is going to ask the following two-word question. Anybody want to tell me what it is? What's next? I don't want to know about that. I really don't, because you're going to make your own decisions. What I'm curious about is, was this thing cathartic? Making this, did it turn out to be cathartic? So when you're actually looking towards the future and what you're doing next, you're coming at it from a different point of view than you were before you made it.
I suspect we all have our own answers for this.
I suspect you do.
For me personally, it was like, I really categorized the two things differently. And maybe this is foolish. Maybe it's all part of one big soup. But like, while we were making this record, I was in the process, at least in my own mind, of like severing myself from this part of my life entirely, of just like deciding I was gonna not be in the band anymore and making peace with that and conceiving of a life that didn't involve being a professional musician any longer. And but at the same time, and that was cathartic, to go through that sort of like crucible of uncertainty into certainty was cathartic. But at the same time, we were making the record, and that to me was just fun. And then I sorted out my shit on the side, and you know, partially because of how much I loved making the record, but like that catharsis sort of took care of itself in like one level, while the creative work was happening on a different, purer, more enjoyable level. So like, when I think of this TPC, when I think of the record, when I play the songs, they don't feel fraught to me. There's no baggage there. They don't remind me, the songs don't remind me of that time in my life. It's like, I have to like think of, I don't know, I have to think of like being in my apartment on the phone or something with Dave, like talking about it, to get back to that state of mind.
The Hell was kind of like a debriefing on our career up to that point, and this record was kind of like us walking out the door and being like, okay, no, we can still do this on terms that we really enjoy, and it still means something to all of us, and we can still put it out. There's still a record sitting on that table, and we did it without all the baggage, like Graham says, that came with a lot of the previous records as well.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by anybody else in between.